those books at some other time. And also in Zephaniah and in Nahum, it's also talking about the great last day, and you have to know what, you know, if you didn't know about the great last day, you wouldn't know how to read into that. But Nineveh also was a symbol of what was going to happen at the end time. The destruction of Nineveh occurred B.C. 606. The city was laid to waste in monuments, its monuments destroyed, and its inhabitants scattered or carried off into captivity. It never rose again from its ruins. And it was about 300 miles there from Babylon. Now here's a statement. The statement in Jonah 4:11 that Nineveh contained more than six score thousand. Remember that? We haven't read that one yet. That comes at the end. All right. Now they all interpret, all of these historians interpret this as infants, as babes. It says infants would indicate the population of about 600,000. And others put it at around 175. I think somewhere in here we may read that others put it up to, including all the suburbs, could be close to 1 million. Now they're all saying that it is the babes, these 600, or the 60,000 infants, would indicate that they were infants because they didn't know their right hand from their left hand. That may be the case, but the way we take it is that God is talking about all of the human beings not knowing their right hand from their left. They're in this satanic society, and they really don't understand. And so we'll get to that in a moment. Some of the things that they uncovered here, the hunting scenes evidently recorded the prowess and personal valor of the king as the head of the people, the mighty hunter before the Lord, of course, who was Nimrod. In the ruins of Nimrod have been found the remains of an ancient library written on stone tablets. Over 10,000 tablets, including almost every subject in ancient literature. Some of the most interesting of these give accounts of the creation and the deluge, the flood, and all agree with or confirm the Bible. It's interesting how all of that happens. The people of Nineveh, I never understood this, the people of Nineveh spoke a Semitic dialect connected with the Hebrew and with the so-called Chaldee of the books of Daniel and Ezra. This agrees with the testimony of the Old Testament. So everything that they find generally always backs up God and the Bible, which of course it should. A couple of things about Nahum, because he gives some other background on Nineveh, as long as we're talking about it. His, of course, is a little bit later on when the full destruction comes. And this is about Nahum. Two of the prophets had to do with Nineveh. Jonah, about 785 B.C. See, they're all a little bit different in their times, and Nahum, about 630 B.C., about 150 years apart. Jonah's was a message of mercy. It turned out that way. Nahum's a message of doom. Together, they illustrate God's way of dealing with nations, prolonging the day of grace, but in the end, visiting punishment for their sins. Now, these are their ideas, remember. Interesting, too, that Nahum came from a little town that either could have been around Nineveh, but the same, and that Nahum may have been Nahum may have been the Israelite captives. There was also a name like this in south of Jerusalem. And it would have been in the same locality as Jonah and Jesus. So they may have come from all the same area there. They're talking here about Nineveh, and it's in Nahum where he says this. This is like a pool of water, the great number of protecting canals along the edges of the walls gave Nineveh this appearance. There's all kinds of canals around the main, like moats, but there were multiple canals around this. Zephaniah also predicted the fall of Nineveh in these words. Nineveh, the joyous city that dwells carelessly and says in her heart, and I remember who else says this, says in her heart, I am, and there is none besides me, shall become a desolation, a place of beasts to lie down in, a wilderness, a pelican and a porcupine shall lodge in the capitals thereof, and everyone that passes by shall hiss. That's in Zephaniah 2:13 and 15. This, of course, talking about the complete and utter destruction of it. But it also gives you the attitude of what was going on. This will give you a little bit different of the physical things here. Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire, which was destroyed, which had destroyed, by this time, it had destroyed Israel. Okay, this is in Nahum's time. Founded by Nimrod shortly after the flood, it had been the beginning, or from the beginning, been a rival of Babylon. Babylon in the south part of the Euphrates River, and Nineveh in the north part of the Euphrates Valley, rather, not river. The two cities were about 300 miles apart. Nineveh rose to world power about 900 B.C. Soon thereafter, it began to cut off Israel. About 785 B.C., God had sent Jonah to Nineveh in an effort to turn it aside from its path of brutal conquest. And that's exactly what happened. Within the following 60 years, by 71 B.C., the Assyrian armies had completed the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. But still, another 100 years, Nineveh continued to grow more and more powerful and arrogant. At the time of Nahum's prophecy, Nineveh was the queen city of the earth. It was the queen city of the earth. Mighty and brutal beyond imagination. This was the type of people and attitude that lived there, and the head of it. Head of a warrior state built on the loot of nations. Limitless wealth from the ends of the earth poured into its coffers. Nahum likened it to a den of raving lions, beasts of prey feeding on the blood of nations. Greater Nineveh was about 30 miles long and about 10 miles wide. Well, the other one said a mile and a half, so maybe he's including the suburbs. It was protected. The main part of Nineveh was protected by five walls and three moats or canals. This is huge. Built by the forced labor of unnumbered thousands of foreign captives. Jonah's mention of 120 babes suggests it might have been a population of near a million. That's where they get that from. The inner city of Nineveh, now this is the inner city of Nineveh proper, about 3 miles long and about a mile and a half wide, built at the junction of these two rivers, was protected by walls 100 feet high. 100 feet high, that's huge! And broad enough at the top to hold four chariots driven abreast on an 8 miles. It was 8 miles in a circuit. This is a huge, big deal. At the very height of Nineveh's power, and on the eve of its sudden overthrow, Nahum appeared with this prophecy called by some as Nineveh's death song, or a cry of humanity for justice, because they just went through the whole earth and just took everything out. Now this is how utter it actually became in history. Its destruction was so complete that even its site was forgotten. Now this great city we just described, it was to nothing, absolutely nothing, when this one great leader and his 10,000 warriors passed by 200 years later. He thought the mounds were ruins of some Parthenian city, some other type of a city. When Alexander the Great fought the famous battle in 331 BC near the site of Nineveh, he did not know there even was a city there, or had been a city there. And that's how, just to nothing. And of course they did uncover this library there, and it had originally contained over 100,000 volumes of these different books and parchments and all the rest. Let me see. I'm not just going to repeat this. Let me look at this real quick. In the case of Nahum, he prophesied probably in Judah within the reign of Josiah. That's when he was doing this. I think we basically have read enough of this. I don't have to keep going. One thing, it says his wealth, however, was not altogether derived from trade. It was a bloody city full of lies and robbery. It plundered the neighboring nations, and it compared, and it is compared by the prophets as a family of lions, and they fill their holes and their dens, ravenous. We've read all of this. Okay, we don't have to read that either. One other thing that I did want to bring up was in his connection is about Isaiah the prophet. Talks about the New Testament, of course, is their spin on this. The New Testament says that Isaiah saw the glory of Christ and spoke of him. He was a prophet of the southern kingdom, Judah. At the time, the northern kingdom, Israel, was destroyed by the Assyrians. So there's a link here. Isaiah lived in the reigns of Uzziah and Hezekiah. Rabbinic tradition has Isaiah's father was a brother of the king, one of these kings. It would make Isaiah first cousin to King Uzziah and grandson of King Joash, and thus of royal blood and a man of the palace. I didn't know that about him. Now his martyrdom. Well, when he was killed, a tradition here states that Isaiah resisted Messiah's idolatrous decrees and was seized, fastened between two planks, and sawn asunder, thus suffering a most painful and horrible death. Yeah, I would think so. Well, that's all I wanted to say about him. But he is connected also with that, with the Assyrians and that. And that's enough of the history. That should give you some idea, at least a little bit, of what was going on in there. Now let's get back into Jonah and read this very quickly in summing up here in chapter 4. So we're back here in Jonah 4. Can you understand a little bit why Jonah didn't want to go there to Nineveh? It was his enemy. He didn't want this to go on. They were beating up on them. And how vast and great Nineveh was in this empire of Syria. And so you can see how God's Spirit did lead him always. He didn't run off on his own. He may not have had the best attitude, but it was still God's Spirit that was directing him. He was God's prophet. So in chapter 4, after God says, all right, I'm not going to destroy the city, it says, but it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was very angry. Of course, he would have liked to have seen Nineveh destroyed and Israel be safe. And he prayed, and we read this before, and he prayed unto the Lord and said, I pray you, O Lord, was not this my saying? See, now you may have a little better understanding of the emotion behind the statement. He says, was this not my saying when I was yet in my own country? He says, therefore, that's why I fled unto Tarshish. For I knew that thou art a gracious God and a merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and that you would change, you know, from this evil, that you wouldn't bring this evil upon them. Therefore now, O Lord, take, I beseech you, my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. Now, what is in Jonah's mind at this point? He gives the message of God. Nineveh's still standing. And God says, okay, I'm going to leave you alone. You know, Jonah has to go back there to Israel. He's got to face everybody. Most of the time, prophets went, said they're going to be destroyed. Boom, the nations were gone. He had to go up there and hold hands with them and then come back. You know, put yourself in that position. Yeah, you knew you were God's servant and you were doing the right thing, but how is the rest of the nation who was being plundered by this city going to react to you? So he said, hey, just kill me. Just kill me. I'd really rather not go through this ridicule when I go back. People start calling me a false prophet here. Then said the Lord in verse 4, you know, doth thou well to be angry? He says, are you greatly angry? So Jonah went out. Now he was still in the city. I noticed as he was still there in the city talking to God. All right. When he said, kill me right here. But he says, so Jonah went out of the city and sat on the east side of the city, and there made him a little booth. And he sat under it in the shadow till he might see what would become of the city. So he wasn't sure, but he was going to sit there. And the Lord God prepared. Now God prepared a gourd. Okay. And it was a fruit-bearing type of little deal here. But it was enough that it was going to cover him. So God prepared this gourd and made it to come up over Jonah, that it might be a shadow over his head to deliver him from his grief. He was in grief of this. Should have been happy. He was in grief. So Jonah was exceedingly glad for this gourd. But God prepared, now God also prepared, a worm. When the morning rose the next day, and it smote the gourd, that it withered. So this little worm crawls up in there and eats into this gourd the next day, and the thing withered. And it came to pass when the sun did arise that God prepared a vehement east wind. It was a very hot desert wind. See, he does everything. He exaggerates things to get the point across here. And the sun beat down upon the head of Jonah that he fainted and wished in himself to die, and said, it is better for me to die than to live. And God said to Jonah, dost thou well to be angry for the gourd? Now, is it good to be angry for this gourd? And he said, I do well to be angry, even unto death. Then said the Lord, thou hast had pity on the gourd. You know, here we're talking about some dumb plant. Here you had pity on this gourd for which thou hast not labored. You didn't labor, neither did you make it, and you didn't make it grow, which came up in a night and perished in the night. Came up, went down. The next night. Because you have pity on this dumb little gourd because you were getting some relief from it.
And yet, he says, and he cuts this very short, he says, and should I not spare Nineveh, that great city wherein are more than 60,000 people that cannot discern between their right hand and their left hand, and also much cattle? And boom, we're at the end of Jonah. Well, he states here, you know, you're having pity on this little plant. In other words, can't you have some pity on the people? Now, what did this really mean? What were we really seeing in this? Well, I want to read from you an article very quickly, and it's going to show you a little bit more of what this lesson of Jonah. This comes from a major article. I just took this part out that we have. I'm just going to read this to you, and I think it'll give you an idea. There's also a spiritual lesson here. God always does things and shows things. It says, the lesson of Jonah. Have you ever considered the end of the matter in the lesson of Jonah the prophet? He was another one that God used for our learning as a witness and example. The most obvious lesson, of course, is that you may run, but you can't hide. You will do exactly what God wants you to do. We, in our righteousness, have tended to laugh at Jonah for doing such a foolish thing. Well, this foolish thing had to take place so that Jonah could be in the fish's belly for those 3 days and three nights. He provided the only sign that God gave to the powers that be, that Christ would be in the grave for only 3 days and three nights. It was the witness, it was for a witness that Satan, who has the power of death, Hebrews 2:14, could not keep him there. However, the most profound lesson that God had provided through Jonah's example is recorded in chapters 3 and 4 of the book of Jonah. Again, this is not against the man Jonah. He was merely an instrument in God's hands, as were King Nebuchadnezzar and Job, to fulfill what God wanted. God is showing what the mind and attitude of Satan and his demons are. That's what he's doing. This is the same carnal mind that Paul spoke of in Romans that is in all of us. Jonah's reaction was only a natural reaction. Of course, with that counterfeit computer chip in us. Again, put yourself in his shoes. You just went through hell for what turned out to be, in your eyes, a wild goose chase. You would feel angry, betrayed, let down, used, and even embarrassed because what you thought was supposed to happen didn't happen. You believed that God was behind you and was going to give these evil people what you knew they deserved. Well, he copped out, and you were left holding the bag. You were made a fool of, at least in his own mind, to a degree. He still had to go back there to Israel. To pick this up again. Well, instead of striking him down dead for this satanic attitude and behavior, God very gently and patiently continued to demonstrate and reveal his mind and attitude on this matter. And to quote, and the Lord God prepared a gourd and made it to come up over Jonah, that it might be a shadow over his head and deliver him from his grief. So Jonah was exceedingly glad of the gourd. This innocent gourd that God caused to grow pictured those people of Nineveh, who in turn pictured all of the human beings that will ever be on this earth. But God prepared a worm when the morning sun, when the morning rose the next day, and it smote the gourd that it withered. That worm pictures none other than the adversary. So what we see here says that the worm pictures none other than the adversary, the devourer, the power of death, Satan, who is responsible for the deaths of all human beings. Brethren, do we see this picture starting to unfold a little bit? You know, God's looking through his eyes and his plan, not just on some little gourd there, but he sees the whole plan. Returning here, God created the waster to destroy. Isaiah 54:16. The gourd, the people, was powerless against the worm, Satan, that took over its life and would ultimately kill it. Notice Micah 3:1-3. It says, this is speaking of the powers that be who are in control of the people. It says, they hate the good and love the evil, who pluck off their skin from them and their flesh from off their bones, who also eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off them, and they break their bones and chop them into pieces as for a pot and as flesh within a cauldron. It is happening to them. They are totally innocent. They are helplessly being consumed. They have no control over what is happening to them. And that is what the people of the world, all of us, have had to go through. Unless we are first fruits and have God's protection, and we're still affected by Satan. Coming back here, it says, as soon as the worm began to bite into the gourd was not the same. It was no longer perfect. It had been marred. It had been polluted. It had been contaminated. It could not function properly. Its direction in life had been altered. It was going to die. That perfect creation that Jonah enjoyed no longer existed. This is exactly what happened when Satan was allowed into the Garden of Eden and caused Adam and Eve to sin. He polluted them. He contaminated them. He was in control of their lives. He has been feasting on the flesh of mankind ever since. Because of this, it is appointed unto men once to die. In Hebrews 9:27. Wherefore, as by one man sinned, Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Romans 5:12. And it came to pass, back here in Jonah, it came to pass when the sun did rise, that God prepared a vehement east wind, and the sun beat upon the head of Jonah, that he fainted and wished in himself to die, and said, it is better for me to die than live. God did this to cause Jonah to appreciate that gourd and what had happened to it. Do you think that he would have given it a second thought on a nice, pleasantly cool, cloudy day? No. He was made painfully aware of how good and precious that gourd was and how much he really cared for it. Because he had that nice strong wind come and get very hot back in Jonah here. And God said to Jonah, doth thou do well to be angry with this gourd? And he said, I do well to be angry. I am greatly angered even unto death. Now Jonah had no anger towards the gourd. He put no blame on this poor victim. He was angry for the sake of the gourd. He was angry at what caused the gourd to wither and die. And so, he says, the Lord says, then said the Lord
Thou hast pity on this gourd, for which you didn't labor, neither did you make grow, which came up in the night and perished in the night. This gourd even portrayed just how temporary and fleeting man's life is. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. James 4:14. For all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man is as the flower of grass. The grass withers away, and the flower therefore falls away. 1 Peter 1:24. And so God goes on to say, he says, can't I, you know, discern? These people can't even discern between their right hand and their left hand. He says, and there's many cattle there too. He says, why should I destroy them? He had compassion and love. God knew what he was dealing with. And we didn't even understand this ourselves. And he was portraying mankind there. And he was showing even through that gourd. Everything that God does has a meaning and a backing to it. So I think we can understand a little bit more about Jonah here. And what has, that he really didn't have this great big bad attitude. And he was being used by God. You know, when you know the true plan of salvation, you begin to have your eyes opened. And as we read through the Bible, we're seeing more and more things. And we're seeing them more through God's eyes. You know, start seeing the Bible through God's eyes. Very clear. God understood Jonah. But we all judged Jonah again, didn't we? We judged Job. We've judged everybody. You know, that's what we do. We call Job unrighteous or self-righteous. And he wasn't self-righteous at all. And we learned that the other week. But we judged him because we didn't know what we were talking about. Jonah was a great prophet of God, and God used him mightily. You know, we had better start to love our forefathers and the ones that God used as his servants. You know, don't judge until you hear the whole matter as God instructs. So we have an overview of what Jonah went through, why he didn't want to go. He knew God was loving and merciful. He knew he wasn't going to destroy that kingdom. Yet he wanted to see the kingdom destroyed, and when it wasn't destroyed, he knew he had to go back to Israel, and his people back there were going to say, well, why didn't you destroy it when you had the chance? And it wasn't God's plan. So you can see the controversy in Jonah's mind and attitude in all of this. But the overall whelming thing that is there is that God's Spirit was with him, God was directing it, and God had Jonah do everything for a purpose, even though we or they may not think that, and even Jonah himself may not think it. God still is running it, and he's still doing it. And we've seen that happen with Mr. Armstrong, we saw it happen with Mr. DeCotch, and you'll see it happen here. There'll be many things that happen that we won't understand or realize, but just have patience and faith that God is doing it, because he is doing it, and he'll work it out. And the people involved may not even know why the things are happening. But it'll always come out right in the end, because God is here. So that gives us a good view of what Jonah went through, and maybe it can help us appreciate the situation he was in. So again, everyone pray for one another during the week, and we will see you again next Sabbath.